A brain tumor diagnosis is a traumatic and life-changing event, resulting in altered priorities as part of a new normal way of life for a patient and their family. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance. Since 2005, we've been creating a dynamic global community for brain tumor patient advocacy organizations and others involved in the field of neuro-oncology. Through our worldwide experience and expertise, we've been working to improve the well-being and quality of life for patients and their families. We advocate for the best treatments, information, and support for brain tumor patients, offering them, their families, and caregivers hope wherever they live in the world. In this series, we'll be meeting some of those working in the field of neuro-oncology, the people who support patients and their families, and those who've been told they have a brain tumor. We'll learn how brain tumors have affected all of these people, often in surprising ways. Welcome to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. Dr. Claire Karakazi is Rwanda's first and only female neurosurgeon, and she's making a difference for her country's brain tumor patients. Her work is admired around the globe, an arena she's quite used to, having studied and practiced neurosurgery in other countries on her journey to where she is now. In this episode, Claire talks to our reporter, Graham Seaman, about why she wanted to become a neurosurgeon, how she copes with the decisions she has to make in the operating theater, the challenges her country still faces in the field of brain surgery, and where she sees the future of neurosurgery going, particularly in her homeland.
Claire, I have to say it's a real pleasure to be talking to you today. Now, when you look at your journey, did you actually ever think you'd be where you are now?
First of all, thank you for having me on air. Honestly, I never thought I would be where I am today. It took many years, took a lot of dedication, took a lot of challenges. But when I look back, I'm pretty happy of what I have accomplished and I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
What makes somebody want to be a neurosurgeon then?
That happened in an unexpected way. So when I was a medical student, I had this golden opportunity to do a rotation in neurosurgery abroad. That time, you know, it was my first time to go to Europe and it was my first time really to go on a flight. And then because it was summertime, they told me most departments close and people go on vacation. But the Department of Neurosurgery, which I didn't understand, will open every day. But now I understand why, because people keep coming, whether you're on vacation or not. So it happened to be the only department that was open that time. And the head of the department accepted me. So I would say that, you know, my first exposure, my first time with this man changed everything. I had little knowledge about neurosurgery, but the way he took me through everything that happened during those 4 weeks became a very big inspiration for me to want to do this kind of training. So you have someone who inspire you to become what you want to become. You know, the challenges with the journey, how you get there. But the exposure, I think, was, you know, the trigger that took me there.
You talked there about the business of inspiration. Has there been one particular person who has inspired you perhaps the most?
In 2007, I'm a fourth-year medical student from Africa, my first time in Europe. And I met this big professor without knowing how big he was actually at that time. You know, when he looked at me, he was like, oh, you're the student who has been emailing me. I said, yes, it's me. So he was like, oh, so have you been in the operating room? I said, no, because the first week when I got there, he was also on vacation. So he said, oh, you need to follow me. So that way of him being big and being humble and being reachable inspired me at that moment. And he said, you have to come, you have to see the brain. He was as excited as I was. So every time he would open, he would show me, ah, see this envelope of the brain, this is how it looks like. Touch. I said, oh, are you sure I can touch? Yes, touch it. So I touched it and I will never forget this man. And then we would sit, talk about neurosurgery. Actually, he started asking me I told you I had really little knowledge. And that time in Rwanda, I remember it was 2007, we had only one neurosurgeon for almost 11 million people. So he will ask me, so how big is Rwanda? So I had to go and dig and come back. Okay. Oh, so how many neurosurgeons do you have? I said, I think we have one.
We all need people like that in life, don't we?
Yes. You need that one person who believes in you. He didn't know me, but he saw delight in my eyes and he said, I know you can make a good one.
What's it like being the only female neurosurgeon in Rwanda in a small group of neurosurgeons? It sounds like a pretty hefty responsibility to me.
Well, it's a lot of pressure and it's a lot of work. And I know the previous male here, the two first male, they really tried. At one time, they were working alone, so they started the training locally, and they have trained. Actually, now we're six, so I'm one of the six. We have now a few trainees and maybe about two incoming neurosurgeons in about 2 years. Neurosurgery is only practiced in the capital city. For a country of 13 million people, for instance, we have three hospitals. We work two by two. So in one hospital, there are two. In the other one hospital, there are two. And the other one, we are two. Each hospital cover a certain area of the country. The area of my hospital being covered is about 5 to 4 million people. So all those 5 to 4 million people will come to you. A lot of things have changed, but I think in terms of delivering neurosurgery care, we still have a long way to go, because if someone leaves in 3 hours, 4 hours, to get diagnosed properly on time, sometimes it's very challenging. If you have someone who just had a road traffic accident, if to get to you, so normally he has to get to you within 1 hour so you can do a brain CT scan. If to get to you, it takes 1 day or 2 days, so more than 5 hours. Sometimes they get to us too late. It's a big challenge. I think we need to train more neurosurgeons and we need to build more centers in various cities apart from the capital city, Kigali. But I think from where we come from and where we are now, we have done incredibly well. People know about neurosurgery. And I remember my time when I was still a medical student, little was known or little was done. So now you can have a CT scan, you can have an MRI, you can have brain surgery for a tumor, you can have brain surgery for whatever pathologies you're having. So it's a lot of work, but we're getting there.
What do you actually think when you're operating on a patient? Are you always able to detach yourself from the emotional and personal side of that person's life fully in order to get the job done? Or is it really important to retain that while you're going through the physical process of helping somebody?
The big mission that brought me back to my country is being able to help my countrymen. Waking up every time at 5:30, going to work, start before 7. Whenever I scrub in for a case, I feel like today I'm going to do my best to help my fellow Rwandese who is sick. Maybe I have the capacity or maybe I have this power to help him go home, get to his family. And actually I was surprised that even doing what I'm doing with limited resources, people are still cured and still go home at the end of the day. I may do 20%, but there's 80% that I absolutely have not control. Sometimes I feel hopeless, but going in theater with that feeling, today I'm coming to help someone, I don't know him, but he's around this, I can help, and I have this capacity that God gave me, and I've been trained to do this. So I go 500%. I go mind, soul, and hands ready to help these people. At the end of the day, when I help someone who goes back home, I feel satisfied. I say, this is why I'm a neurosurgeon. This is why I'm here. This is why I came back to Rwanda.
And do you find that patients want to sort of stay in touch with you, because you are building this relationship with patients, you're doing a professional job. But you are changing people's lives. You're saving people's lives. You're giving them the hope that perhaps they wouldn't have had before. That's a big deal.
Well, I know my colleagues are doing the same. Of course, because we have a lot of patients that come to us, you cannot have a particular relationship with everyone. But one thing for sure, I remember all my tumor patients. Even if they are 50, but I can put a name and a face at everyone. And I know what I did for everyone. I know how is everyone doing. But that's the kind of connection you build with them. The time for follow-up, I make sure they come to see me. At least if they cannot come, I make sure I know they're still alive. They need maybe a follow-up MRI. Some still text me. They will tell me, oh, I'm doing well. So I'm like asking, when are you coming back for the follow-up MRI? It's quite something.
Clearly, you've travelled the world and you've learnt a lot about your field of work in terms of how other countries do things. You've alluded already to the fact that, you know, those experiences you can bring back to Rwanda. Does it work the other way around? Do you think there are things that the rest of the world could learn from the way that you do things in Rwanda?
Absolutely, yes. First of all, I did not do my training in neurosurgery here, but when I started practicing here, I was surprised by how cases get to us, even a small tumor that you will easily diagnose abroad. When it comes to you here, it's a huge tumor. So I would say we have a particular environment and we have to be able to provide a particular care to these people when they get to you. Even the small hemorrhage, the big hemorrhage, everything is huge. And in my first days, I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? But I found out that colleagues who are practicing here, they are dealing with this, and you start learning how to deal with this. And I've had a couple of students who came to see me from abroad. And I've had my former sponsor who came to do some cases with me twice. And he was also surprised. He said, you have like challenging cases, huge cases, and cases that need big decisions. Here, sometimes, you know, I'm the last person to take the last decision. So I talk to various professors and they will say, okay, try to do what you can do, try to do this and this. But at the end of the day, you know, you are the doctor here. So I believe there's a lot we can teach them. The diseases are the same, but sometimes the levels of the disease are different. They are quite advanced and you have to do something. I've been learning a lot for the last 3 years and it's really something, yeah.
How would you say that your experience in life and what you've been through has changed you as a person?
So I am someone who is impatient. Usually I want things to happen the way I want them to happen. I want them to happen very quickly. But what my experience taught me, and it happened even when I came back here, is patience and what we call grit. Until I started reading about grit, I really didn't know that I was a great example of grit. So you need to have patience. You need to have consistency. And if you're chasing something, you need to be consistent. So I was being consistent without knowing while being patient for someone who is impatient. So I learned that even if things are not turning out the way you want them at that particular moment, keep that spirit of keep working, keep being patient as long as you providing what you like, you feel like you're there in your heart and you feel like you're being honest in your heart.
Do you sense that the world is changing more towards young people who are keen to find their way into medicine, particularly people from your own background?
Yes, I think the world is changing, and I think a woman can dream to do STEM. She can be supported. There has been a lot of awareness. Now there are role models to follow. You know, when we started, we had no one to look up to. But now I believe the younger generation, they'll have us, of course, to guide them, and they'll be looking up to us. So that's whether we want it or not, we carry this big mission of inspiring the younger people to do what they want to do, even if they don't choose medicine or they don't choose STEM. At least, you know, they can dream to go higher. They can dream to get what they want to do. They can know that there's, you know, there may be time, there may be delays, but there's no limitation to whatever you want to do.
You mentioned about dreaming high there. I seem to understand we've read somewhere that you would love to be an astronaut.
So, yeah, because in high school, I did mathematics and physics. So I was somehow convinced that I would become a mathematician or an astronaut. Dreaming to become an astronaut was probably dreaming to become, you know, something big. And I think I'm an astronaut in my field now.
If you got the phone call tomorrow to go into space, would you go?
I don't know. I think I will consider it.
If you think about it, the space race has helped to develop so much in the modern world technologically and from a medical point of view as well. And I suppose the same thing would happen with neurosurgery. We can learn a lot from those kind of experiences. Now, I want to talk about your perception of where we are with neurosurgery at the moment. How do you see its development in terms of treatment, and where do you see the future of it going?
Neurosurgery is a field that relies on, first of all, technology, a lot of technology. It's a field that is changing every day. It's a field that relies on research and people who are working nonstop to get a care or treatment for some of the challenging diseases like glioblastomas and others. For instance, here we are able to help people who have like accident, who have hematomas that can be cured. But we need to get to a point where we can help people who also have some complex diseases that need a lot of technology or that need a lot of research. And for that to happen in low and middle income countries, we still have a long way to go. I will give you an example. If, you know, I'm dealing with a high grade glioma or what we call brain cancer or any other cancer of the brain that will need not only the hands of the surgeon, because you will feel limited, but also needs some chemotherapy that is still very expensive to get here, that will need some research to see some people who are doing well, who may need target therapies, which we do not particularly have here, that will need some technologies that are being, you know, used in high-income countries but we don't have here. I want these things in our countries. I'm a neurosurgeon, but I'm not going to limit my potential. I want to evolve. I want to evolve as someone who is in a higher-income country, offer the same kind of treatment. Unfortunately, they are being developed in the Western countries rather than African or other low and middle income countries.
Finally, Claire, this series is all about hope for patients and their families. I mean, how do you see the future of this kind of science?
I think everything I do is about hope. I'm telling you, every time I wake up and I go to work, sometimes I don't have all the answers. But when I enter, I'm ready to help someone. I go in with the hope that this person is going to be fine, even though I'll be limited in what I can provide, but that hope proves to give all the answers. So as long as, you know, you believe you're doing a great mission, you see miracles happening, you cannot explain. There are some people I've operated on, they make it in a miracle way. I'm unable to explain what happened, but I think it's hope. Because these people are hoping to be better, and you as a doctor, you're hoping for them to be better. And, you know, you get through this with hope.
Our reporter, Graham Seaman, talking to Dr. Claire Karakazi, Rwanda's first and only female neurosurgeon. In our next episode...
It was a glioblastoma, and it was on his left side. I didn't know if I was going to survive. I think it's also important to ask for help because you cannot handle all of this on your own. I just kept writing and writing and writing, and even on Christmas Eve was writing music. I've been able to use the film as a canvas for all my emotions.
That was singer-composer Christine Halls from Norway, who lost her stepfather to a brain tumor. Christine will be talking about how her love of music, performing in Disney's Frozen and Frozen 2 movies, and scoring her very first feature film, have helped her cope emotionally, while also discovering hope in the darkest of times. I'm Kathy Oliver, Chair and Co-Director of the International Brain Tumor Alliance, and you've been listening to A Brain Tumor and Me, a journey of inspiration, personal stories, and hope. If you'd like to find out more about the work we do, just go to our website, theibta.org. And thank you for listening. This has been a Graham Seaman Media production for the IBTA.